and it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, Arts and Entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, once again, music from and conversation with Andy Timmons. On the previous KVC Arts, we heard about a piece Andy wrote with Peter Frampton in mind and then had Frampton play on it. A quick bit as well, touching on his time with Olivia Newton-John and then starting an exploration of his newest release, a mostly instrumental, guitar-driven album called Recovery, just out. This edition of KVC Arts continues that exploration and a look at the themes running through and through. Going into the program, one called Love Greater Than Hate. Love Greater Than Hate. Now, this starts with this anthemic build and build, but then around 45 seconds in, you have some of these hanging emotional kind of notes, and we start to get this rapid build and tempo on the bass. Then the whole thing really takes off. So was this an up-tempo tune from inception, or that intro was really that, you know, something to work toward, this fast attack thing that you had going on?
Yeah, as I recall, the ideas just kind of all came in a linear fashion. This was one easier tune to write. So yeah, I mean, obviously it's the eternal struggle of good and evil. Love is greater than hate, you know. At least that's my optimism. You know, light in the face of darkness. My favorite thing about the piece, clearly it starts off as a motive in a rather pretty melody in some ways, you know, though contemplative. And then that section kicks in. Like you said, the bass and drums kick up in quite a high energy. And Josh Smith immediately recognized it. You know, it was a bit live and let die-ish, very James Bondish. And he picked up on that and came up with some of those cool string lines that I played the guitar along with. But my favorite part of the song is after all that, then it drops back down to a theme from the beginning. Yeah. And then the band comes back in full steam at the end, and it's the earlier melody, but now in full 4/4 time instead of half time. And the whole emotion just kind of lifts, like, it's going to be okay after all this turmoil and tumult. We're going to be all right, you know. That's always my eternal optimism and the way I'm trying to lead my life, you know. We'll get through any of this dark stuff, but not without losing sight of what's really important, you know. Just taking care of ourselves, loving those around us, and passing it on as much as we can.
Does that tie in a way to when it ends? You hit a note and leave it right there. And that's my preference, I think. I used to feel that when a tune fades out, it was like, oh, well, they just couldn't find the note on which to end. But now, since then, I found many, many tunes in which the fade out kind of illustrates a point of the melody overall.
Oh, for sure.
But for this, it makes perfect sense, or it made wonderful sense to hit a note, and it's that last bit of sustain, a resonance, not only in the sound, but in our thinking as well. That really ties into what you just said.
Thank you. Yeah. But it does, it leaves a bit of a question mark. If we're going to get analytical, and for the first time, I'm looking at this. Most songs would end if there's a last note. It's usually the tonic or the one or the root of the key, which in this case is G. Mm-hmm. That last note is G sharp or A flat, which is a flat nine, which is a tension note. Love is greater than hate, but it's not guaranteed. You know, it's a battle, you know what I'm saying? So in that way, I leave the idea hanging a bit. I'm not ending on a real pretty major seven chord going, puppies and kittens and butterflies, you know. You know, it's meant to outline in the stressful times we find ourselves in. So
to be continued with that question mark.
To be continued, that's right.
Oh, boy, wow. Okay, the next one, going on to Between Brothers, it kicks off with a really cool stereo effect. Is that just a pick running up the neck in each channel?
Yeah, this is a classic pick scrape.
Okay.
And, you know, wasn't done. It's on one performance, but then we just did a trick with the panning just to give it some energy.
Oh, okay.
It's like a pick scrape, then a left hand going down the neck, then a pick scrape, then the hand going down the neck.
Ah.
So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, pick scrape, left hand going down the neck, pick scrape, left hand going down the neck, and that's what leads us into that downbeat.
Oh, cool. Yeah. people, I will have that playing before we start talking about it, or maybe may have to have it after you state that. But there's definitely a phrase which I think might have been the beginning of this one. I also wondered, though, at one point if this one was played live to tape, as it were. Some songs have a feel of a true jazz recording, like the old rockabilly thing,
right,
just get around the microphone and do it.
No, this would have been done, I played it live with the band, but after the initial sessions, I replaced most of what I originally recorded just to get a better performance for myself. You know, we were concentrating on getting the band, bass, drums, and keyboards to their best, and we weren't focused that much on guitars. I did that in my own home studio.
Oh.
So no, this I would have done it in sections, because there's some sections that have very different attitudes, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
And slightly different tones, so yeah.
By the way, why Between Brothers as a title?
That was initially, and it's not a familial brother, but a friend brother. Just how things aren't always smooth with your circle, you know what I mean? And this is dedicated to a lifelong friend of mine. But then you go through periods where maybe there's a little dust up or something. So it's just kind of meant to be that, okay, there's always a lot of love, but every now and then there's going to be some tension. But in the end, you know, repeat after me, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right.
Nice.
But just kind of recognizing, yeah, it's not always smooth sailing, but like any other relationship, it takes work. And every now and then going, hey, checking in, making sure everything's okay. Things can be easily misunderstood or, you know.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah.
I appreciate the depth on some of these answers. Some of the simple statements, but
they're
saying a lot. Lost in this world. Titling of instrumental tracks, the inspiration can come from so many places, but did the title come first on this one by chance? Or at least did you know, because of the feel of the tune, did you know that you were really going to lose yourself?
I had a mood and an idea, and a friend, he does a lot of missionary work in Europe, and he was helping a bunch of Romanian refugees, young people working in the sex trade, and he was getting them out of it, basically.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of thinking about people that are lost or without a home, but it's also personal.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I feel lost in this world. As Brian Wilson would say, I just wasn't made for these times. You know, we grew up together in Evansville, Indiana, but he lives all over the world now. But he was in town and was going to come over to visit me. And with him in mind, I composed that track before he got to the house, just as a gift and as a, hey, I'm thinking of you. And this mood struck me after our conversation. And it's funny, because after hearing the piece, I thought it really created something beautiful. But he also recognized at the end, now this is before the band is recorded, this is just my demo on my home studio. But it had the same shape, and it gets to the end, and he says, yes. And he loved that there was this optimism at the end that they're going to be okay, that they're going to get through this darkness, you know. Not knowing that it was going to lead to being on this record where that's the theme. So many of these things just kind of happened one-on-one in their own little worlds, but it's all kind of pieces together to feed into the overall narrative. But that's the specific inspiration, you know. But the refugee idea and being lost in a world with no home, I mean, I think we can all feel that way in some ways. Nothing like some of these actual refugees, of course, but it can feel that way to some when they just don't feel like they resonate, like they wish they could in every environment, you know.
Truly. It belongs nicely. It has a nice place within the disc. It brings us down slightly. Oh, that was poorly phrased. The tempo is slower, and the drive for it is much more of a meditation.
Yeah, you need some peaks and valleys.
Yes.
It's a nice mood. And the guitar tone is a little different than I normally capture. And for the guitar geeks, it's like that second position out of phase on a Stratocaster. So the guitar on the main portion of the song is a 1960 hardtail Stratocaster, but in that second position. So it's the first two pickups out of phase with each other. So it's a very particular, recognizable, clean guitar sound. But I thought I got a really nice recording of that particular iteration.
There's a couple of people I know that is going to make perfect sense of them. You name
exactly.
The year and the pickups.
Yes, they will.
This one had a humbucker, and this one, okay, excellent, excellent.
Guitar geeks unite.
Oh, yeah, they're there.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Andy Timmons, speaking mainly about his 2025 release, Recovery. More at andytimmons.com, and more as KVC Arts continues. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Going to one called Why Must It Be So? And we'll hear about my minor struggle with that title in just a moment. Also a really cool vocal piece with a really cool story behind it, and a drastically different sound than the rest of the album. Why must it be so? And I'll admit that I thought the first part of the title had been cut off on the file transfer, because all I had was, why must it be so? And I spent time looking for the rest, even requesting liner notes.
Oh, no.
My question surrounding this is, it makes me want to know about the construction of an instrumental. Have you by chance read the foreword by Steve Vai for Steve Lukather's The Gospel According to Luke?
I have the book, and I ashamedly have not cracked it, so I need to get to that eventually.
That
forward,
to severely and unfairly truncate it, Steve talks about getting this cassette. And on the back, it was a performance at the Baked Potato. It was just a great, great jam. And it was later he realized that it was Lukather. But before that, not only was he getting into it, but he was realizing that this was a blueprint for how to make something epic. This was a definitive sound form. It was one of those moments. When I listened to Why Must It Be So, that's what I thought of, this type of definitive instrumental recording, what to do and how to get there kind of thing.
Thank you, man. Well, this all feeds into what we're talking about as far as an artist's Arlect. Steve recognized that about Lukather, but that's Steve perceiving it that way in his world. That's what it means to him. And certainly I will have had, with Steve and I will have some mutual inspirations, no doubt, meaning vibe. But then it's how we take it forward and what we do with it, you know. But he combined that with his passion for Frank Zappa, and that's what sets Steve apart in so many ways, is that there's just going to be this much broader stroke of intellect and humor, but combining it with what he heard at Luke's band at the Baked Potato. Some epic fusion jam. If you consider what would have influenced my writing of Why Must It Be So, it's very Beatles. There's a bit of Procol Harum in there.
Oh.
In a particular spot, Salty Dog. But then it's the overall emotion of it, you know. By the time it hits the chorus, I'm not sure what that is, but it is me. But it's coming from all these different areas. But wanting it to have this particular, you know, that is a more epic-y kind of sound. Some of the textures I end up using, some of the keyboards on that I did at my studio that were just taken from the demo, the way I originally conceived it, was some Mellotron, some kind of vintage-y sounding, haunting strings and voices. And so it's uplifting, but there's darkness there at the same time.
Gotcha. Beautiful.
And Why Must It Be So? You could just apply that to so many things.
Yeah.
It works. One sweet thing about instrumental music is that it's not really confined to the written, spoken word. It can have a very specific meaning for myself, but really can be taken by the listener to mean whatever they need it to mean. You know, however it moves them and wherever they need to go, music can help in so many great ways. It can help people feel the deeper things that maybe they weren't allowing themselves to feel, be it sadness and grieving or just lifting them up.
Truly.
Sometimes people need that soundtrack to help that. And that's what music has given me, and if I can be that for some other people too, that's the biggest success in my mind, you know.
Now, you most certainly have in many ways and many times for me, and I've been glad to be able to introduce you and your music to some people as well, and so it's great to be able to get this from you. And it's also what I appreciate about instrumental music, is that you don't have any words telling you, okay, Barney's telling you to clap your hands now or just whatever, this is what you do now. But
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that said, I'm going to ask about the one song with lyrics here, Something Good's Gonna Come. This one had oh boy, you'll either hang up or love it, but this one had a bit of a Last Dance with Mary Jane feel to it as it goes into it.
There's no coincidence that
okay,
I'm
good.
A huge Petty fan.
The first thing I thought of is that, like Electric Truth, this is a mostly instrumental album. Did you feel you needed to put something with words in there for those who need that kind of thing? Or was this song came together and it's like, boom, I love it, it's going in?
That's exactly how it happened. Some songs get written, recorded, and released. This song I've had for years.
Oh.
I don't know how long ago. Over 10 years I've had that riff. And most of the lyrics done. I had the basic idea, you know, the chorus, something good's going to come. Lately I've been searching for myself because I don't recognize this empty shell. I did a recording with two different drummers in my band. We tried it. And we're not really a vocal band, but every now and then we will do something with vocals. But it just never felt like we hit the sweet spot with it. But just a couple of years ago, I was collaborating with a singer named John Christopher Davis, who was doing a record with Stan Lynch of the original Heartbreakers band.
Yeah.
So I was co-writing some things. I said, man, I've got this song I've never finished. And so he loved the tune, and so we finished the lyrics. And John and Stan and I and Mike Dane on bass from my trio, we recorded a really nice version of John's record. It may or may not come out on the record. They have a band called The Speaker War. So the first set of recordings just came out. I thought, you know what? The song turned out so great. You know, when I was putting together tunes to go to Josh's studio, let's do this song. And the narrative fits perfectly. If I'm going to have one vocal tune on the record, it illustrates the entire idea of, okay, you know, as dark as things get, something good's going to come. You're going to hit that wall sometimes to get through it. But yeah, I'm really proud of that tune. It does have a very Petty-ish feel to it. And I'm a huge Tom fan, and getting Stan involved on the lyrics was just the right thing. It just made total sense, and he did a great job getting it over the finish line. So we will likely do some more stuff together. We really have a good time playing together.
Oh, that would be phenomenal. And that song, it's such a song of confidence. I mean, knowing with a capital K, something good is gonna come. I considered at times it could be a quiet but desperate plea of hope in the middle of reflection. Something about the phrasing, watching the colors fade to black, and then there's almost another, it's like another voice saying, that's no way to live. These parenthetical statements after certain phrases, is this a conscience speaking to you, or more like advice from one person to another?
Well, that's a very specific quote I got from somebody. I was at the darkest point of my life, meaning I had a severe hearing issue called hyperacusis. Major ringing is tinnitus, which I've had that for many, many years. But at one point, this goes back to 2011, that really shot up and was becoming really difficult to deal with. But then added to that was this condition called hyperacusis, which is the sensitivity to loud sound. So music became unlistenable and unplayable. So you can only imagine what that did to my emotional well-being, where who am I if not the musician, the guitarist? You know?
Yeah.
Luckily, I got through this for a multitude of reasons, and I'll spare the long story, but I'd gone to a hearing specialist in Dallas. Oh, yeah, you've got really bad ringing. Nothing you can do about it. Not as bad as mine, though. Well, we'll get you these earplugs, you know. And I go to pick them up, and the nurse, that when I pick up the earplugs from, goes, oh, tinnitus, that's so horrible. That's no way to live. You know, some people kill themselves.
Mm.
She's talking to a person that's not far from just being okay with that. You know what I mean? And to say that, that's no way to live.
Wow.
That stick with you, you know? I just walked out. I didn't even know how to handle that, but it was not the right thing to say. I never complained about it, but of course I never went back. But that was a dark thing. I've never told anybody that story. But that's where that line comes from, you know?
Do you want me to keep that off the air?
I have no problem you keeping that on the air. People need to hear that. Yeah, I've talked at length on other interviews about mental health and depression and all these subjects. There was one particular interview I did with a woman for Guitar World magazine about mental health. It took me a while to say yes to do it, but I'm glad I did, because I've had people come up to me that were helped by that. By just discussing issues, you know, and just being honest and open. When I think that's something we all need to be better at, not putting up any facade. Here's what's really going on, folks, you know. You're not alone, because I think everybody struggles in private sometimes, and it makes it hard. But that's where that line comes from.
I'm seeing it now in a different way. Instead of watching all those colors turn to black, which made me first think of a stunning sunset, but then with That's No Way to Live, I thought I wanted to look at it as a withering rose in a vase. But now I'm seeing it's leaving it open to become vibrant and beautiful again. So this became a something of hope. Almost Home. The title may be leading me on this, it wouldn't surprise me, but some of those top of the fretboard can't go any higher moments. It's this close to a crying. So if you were to produce one of those epic, on the road kind of videos, the stadiums or clubs filling up and all those, this is the one. So am I reading into it because of the title? This is mournful. I want to be home. I love it on the road, and I'm crying at the same time.
I think that's the beauty of instrumental music. It's not really what I had in mind, but it is. Everybody's always kind of longing to be home and to feel that final comfort of peace. And Almost Home referring just to an overall, as we age and getting closer to whatever that is. The initial riff is purely, this riff started off as something without a title. It wasn't called Almost Home, which is something I wrote after seeing Steve Morse. And on the back cover of the record, the song's dedicated to Steve. Because when I saw the Dregs reunion they did a handful of years ago, I was fortunate enough to go play with them.
Was
an incredible honor. The thing I remember about that show was I'd known Steve on and off over the years, just meeting him and maybe doing a show here and there. My friend Jennifer Batten was coming to town. She's a big Dregs fan, so she wanted to come. And Andy West was back in the band, so he invited us to come play. This is great. We get to the venue, and they're playing my Sgt. Pepper record over the PA as their pre-show music.
Oh, how cool.
And I'm noticing when I walk in, all the crew is like real happy to see me. Like, I wouldn't expect them to know me. But they've been playing this record every night. That was their main...
They
played the whole record before every show. I was like, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard. But okay, so let me truncate the story in that seeing Steve playing this body of work, it was very much like I was referring to Frampton earlier. There's just nobody that thinks like he does musically. It's just so unique to Steve Morse, how he combines the Baroque and country and rock stuff in the Southern way. That's just nobody's ever done it like that, and it's just so unique to him. So that kind of rolling Baroque-ish kind of chord progression is what I came home that night and started writing that. And I had that basic sequence just that first set of arpeggios, for several years. I would just keep playing it going, I really love this. I don't know what to do with this, but I really love this, And then as it came time to put songs together for the record, I really need to finish this. I almost reached out to Steve and asked him to help me finish writing it, but that never came to fruition. But I think overall, it is a longing to go home and recognizing that, like Paul McCartney's record, Memory Almost Full. Okay. Which I thought was a great title for a later, not that this is the late career for me, but it's, I'm 61. Huh? I'm hoping to have another 20 or 40 years left. But, you start to feel your age a little bit, so you become more aware of immortality, as they say.
God, is it life on the road or gardening? It still hits your lower back.
It hits your lower back. For me, it's my knees, so I'm working on it, though.
Oh, my gosh. Arizona Sundown. Now, I had always thought of you as an Indiana guy, though with Dallas and a fair amount of time in Flushing, Queens for a dangerous part of your life.
Yeah. That's a very fun
See
part.
See what I did there? Yeah. But no, I just found out that you spent your first couple of years in Arizona. That's where you were actually born. And so this is maybe complex to get to very little, but people hear it as I'll be playing this in the background while we speak, and it's going to have such a difference between the rest of this album that they've been hearing. I'd really like to hear about what we're hearing, because there's this minor modulation gain up and down. Maybe it's processing, but I really want to know if you were by chance playing a B bender.
Yeah, that's a really cool string bending device. But no, I never owned one of those. I would like to have a Telecaster outfitted. It's an effect called tremolo.
Oh.
and it's modulating the volume of the instrument. Think about the voice on Crimson and Clover at the end. That's that kind of effect. But on guitar, it can be used a lot in country music or alt-rock kind of stuff. It's just a cool, earthy, vibey kind of sound. On your notes, does it say Arizona Sundown?
Yeah, I had it written down in two different ways, between the liner notes that were sent and another listing that I saw.
Well, Arizona Sunset is the final title, but I struggled between Sundown and Sunset for the longest time. And it was written both ways, so I'm wondering if it got out as Arizona Sundown in some different format. So
I'm going to have to double check on that.
You're not wrong, but the intended title finally was Arizona Sunset. So this kind of ties into almost home in a way. My family, as it existed in Arizona, when I was born there in 63 and moved in 68, but that was the last time the family was really together because my parents divorced at that time. And of course, my parents are gone. One out of the four brothers are gone. You know, we're heading off into the sunset in a way, and I really wanted a song just dedicated to my fondness for Arizona because of all the fond early memories, but also, you know, the melancholic feeling that goes along with as family members start to go, especially me being the youngest. You know, I'm bound to experience this more than the others. But this song really turned out well. And like so many of my ballads, people gravitate to them because of the emotional content and the feeling they get from it. So very different sounding from the rest of the record, but I think it's a good album closer. It's that optimistic.
For this edition of KVCR's, it's been Music and Conversation with Andy Timmons, speaking mainly about his 2025 release, Recovery. More at andytimmons.com. Also, the rest of that conversation is at kvcrnews.org/arts. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVCR's. With thanks again to Andy Timmons, and here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, Champ Chipman, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And again, most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. Though this time it's Andy Timmons all the way. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.